and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the Supreme Court said today that it would stay out of a dispute for now over the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA, meaning the Trump administration is unable to end the program on March 5th as it had wanted. Next, the White House on Saturday released the Democratic Party's redacted response to the Nunes memo, but the document is underwhelming. Most importantly, it does not refute Republican assertions that the FBI is biased against the Trump administration. Then, China's Communist Party has cleared the way for President Xi Jinping to remain in power indefinitely by abolishing term limits for the presidency. This is a major break from decades-old rules meant to prevent development of a Mao-like consolidation of power in the hands of one man. And then momentum is the key word in what could be a true rapprochement between North and South Korea. The possibility of direct talks between the two is a real one, but will U.S. preconditions scuttle any chance of success? And finally, Senator Dianne Feinstein, arguably the most important politician in the state of California, was snubbed over the weekend when the Democratic Party declined twice to endorse her for re-election. She faces a stiff challenge from State Senate President Kevin DeLeon. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to the Supreme Court and DACA. The Supreme Court said today that it would stay out of a dispute for now over the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA, meaning that the Trump administration is unable to end the program on March 5th as it had wanted. We're joined from New York by Juan Carlos Ruiz, co-founder of New Sanctuary Coalition, and we're joined from Washington by Brent Wilkes. He is a leading immigrant rights advocate. Gentlemen, welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Let's start with you, Brent. I was struck by the news this morning that the Supreme Court was going to stay out of this for now. What exactly does that mean, for now? Are they going to revisit this issue?
Well, yeah, so the Trump administration had really sought an extraordinary effort that would bypass the appeals court in order to go straight to the Supreme Court, that rarely ever successful, and they certainly got rebuked by the Supreme Court. So it wasn't actually a surprise that the Supreme Court said that they weren't going to hear the case. What we can expect now is for the appeals court to hear the case, as they should have in the first place. And in the meantime, the DACA program is allowed to continue and that people who come up for renewal can renew their status. But this is not a permanent solution at all. And, if things go badly with the appeals court, we could see this program being terminated at any time in the future. So it's a good day, but it isn't necessarily a solution to the problem.
And Juan Carlos, this is going to go through the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And the Ninth Circuit has, I think, been generally receptive to arguments on the side of DACA recipients. Do you expect the Ninth Circuit to discharge this to the Supreme Court with a recommendation, or not even a recommendation, but with a finding that the Trump administration's position on DACA is illegal?
You see, I think we need to take into consideration the political climate that we are living in. And if we can describe it in a short note, it will be, this is a bullying administration. And they have managed to vilify, demonize our youth. And so by doing so, the door that was open, though it's not a solution, but at least people have the feet, on the door, inside the door, inside the room. This is practically kicking people out of the room. And we see this climate that is doing so, not only, against our youth, but in general. This is a general attack against human decency, a general attack in terms of the dignity of all people. We keep saying, if they are coming for us in the morning, they will come for you in the afternoon. And that's how it's been characterized, not only on the news, on the airwaves, but we keep seeing this harassment and assault to human decency.
Brian, I'm struck by a statement that Donald Trump made to a room full of governors this morning, just after this Supreme Court decision came out. He said, and this is a quote, he said, You know, we tried to get it moved quickly because we'd like to help DACA. I think everyone in this room wants to help DACA, but the Supreme Court just ruled that it has to go through the normal channel, so it's going back in. There won't be any surprise. I mean, it's really sad when every single case filed against us, this is in the Ninth Circuit, we lose, and then we do fine in the Supreme Court. But what does that tell you about our court system? It's a very, very sad thing. So DACA's going back, and we'll see what happens from here. But that's not really it at all. This is Donald Trump reverts to just attacking the courts when he doesn't get what he wants. He is disingenuous when he says that he loves DACA, he supports DACA. It's Donald Trump that's trying to end DACA, but he really does believe that this Supreme Court, which is conservative in its ideology, is going to end up coming down on the side of Donald Trump.
Let me ask Brent, just for some legal guidance, or guidance about the legal situation. If the appeals court upholds the lower court, the federal district court ruling, and says that the Trump administration acted in an arbitrary and capricious way, I think in violated the I don't know what it's called, the Administrative Procedures Act or something like that. If the appeals court rules like that, and there's no split decision with another circuit, another appeals court, what's the likelihood under those circumstances of the Supreme Court taking a decision if there's no, in other words, no disunity at the appeals court level?
You know, I think that's a great point. And what could happen there is that the Supreme Court would decline to even hear the case and say, look, if you want to end DACA, as the president said he wants to do, there's a proper process to do that. Nobody's claiming that the president doesn't have the authority to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program because the presidency basically created the program in the first place. So clearly, if it can be created by the president, it can be changed or modified or ended by the president. But what Donald Trump did wrong is he didn't file the Administrative Procedures Act, and that's how the courts, how the plaintiffs were able to get a court decision saying that he had violated that act. I think that the appeals court will uphold that opinion. If they do it unanimously, I think it puts a lot of pressure on the Supreme Court to just say, look, you know, if you want to change DACA, you got to do it the proper way and follow the Administrative Procedures Act. And so that does give a lot more time for this to wind its way through the courts and then force the Trump administration to go back and do it properly. Or they could just give up the case and make another effort to try to end the DACA program in a way that does follow the court case. But it does give time, which is a good thing, because Congress so far has been unable to get a bipartisan bill passed through the Congress that would provide a permanent solution for the DACA recipients and all Dreamers, for that matter, and allow them to get on a pathway to citizenship, which is what everybody believes needs to happen in order to help make sure that this class of individuals isn't under threat of deportation in the future.
Juan Carlos Ruiz, let me ask you this, because I think Brent has struck upon something that's extremely important from a tactical point of view, which is this gives time to the Dreamers. And I know, and I think all of us who are involved in organizing know, sometimes time is of critical importance. If the process ends, then it ends. If the process doesn't end, you have more time to build support. You are right that there has been a concerted effort to demonize, and you can see by the court's own the government's own representations to the Supreme Court, demonizing young people, demonizing these young Dreamers. At the same time, there's vast public support and sympathy for the Dreamers. It would seem to me that the issue right now, especially when it's at the courts, and we know the courts aren't just about legal things, they're also about and reflective of public pressure, it would seem to me that this time gives us, people who believe in justice, an opportunity for massive organization, mobilization, and education so that this actually can be achieved. In other words, to push the pendulum back in the opposite direction. Go ahead.
I think we need to find also new ways to hold politicians accountable, because we do see the great disconnect. I mean, we see massive mobilizations with gun control. We see massive mobilizations in terms of immigration reform. We keep saying, you know, that people are really out on the streets, in the courts, just about everywhere, pushing for some kind of policy that makes sense, that is reasonable. But it seems that we still lack the systems to hold people accountable on the higher, you know, on the higher escalons of power. We do need to find ways that we can locally hold our politicians, our elected officials, you know, hold their feet to the fire. And we do need to do that. This gives us time. This gives us time. I think we also have to really make the connections, the, you know, connect the dots in terms of, this is not just for our youth. You know, there are parents who also are dreamers. There is a wider movement of people, you know, 11 plus million people who are in the shadows still, and that they need a resolution. It seems that we keep investing on this machinery of death and deportation, and, you know, and it's not working. We need to ask ourselves, really, you know, are we going to be the solution? Are we part of the solution? Or what is our role in this mess that we have?
Brett Wilkes, we have just under 30 seconds. Why don't you give us your parting thoughts?
Well, I think the Reverend's absolutely right. We've got to do something about the political situation because, you know, even with the additional time, it's unclear that this Congress is going to do anything to help Dreamers. And that's just really unfortunate, and not paying attention to the overwhelming public support of doing something to help the Dreamers. So we've got to get to the polls this coming November. We've got to make sure that we're choosing individuals who are going to reapproach this issue in a way that is let's get the job done type of attitude. And that ultimately is, I think, where we need to get action is a new Congress with a new attitude, and hopefully one that will really look at the Dreamers and say they want to solve the problem.
Well, we're going to leave it right there. We were joined from New York by Juan Carlos Ruiz, co-founder of New Sanctuary Coalition, and we were joined from Washington by Brent Wilkes. He's a leading immigrant rights advocate. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The White House on Saturday released the Democratic Party's redacted response to the Nunes memo, but the document is underwhelming. Most importantly, it doesn't refute Republican assertions that the FBI is biased against the Trump administration. We're joined from New York by Ted Rall. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. And also joining us from New York is Jim Cavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. Guys, we're happy to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
You know, I've got to tell you, I waited with bated breath.
In the words of Shakespeare, much ado about nothing.
Much ado about nothing. I couldn't wait to read it. And then when I read it, I thought, where's the beef? Ted Rall, tell us what you think.
You know, do we really have to keep even having these discussions? Because this is what happens with every single development in this Russiagate thing. I'd like to, you know, in the interest of laziness and efficiency, I will pre-record my future responses to this exact question, and you can just run it. And, you know, if my connection goes down, no one will ever know the difference. It's going to go on forever and ever and ever.
Wasn't that the voice of Ted Rall?
I mean, I'm cracking up because it's so ridiculous. It's just like people forgot how to do journalism or something. I mean, you know, I look at the list of highlights of the supposed highlights. Even according to mainstream media sources like NPR, we have headlines like the FBI investigated other people. Republicans have not budged from their earlier attack. The feds collected valuable intelligence, whatever that means, from Carter Page. There's just, I'm sorry, you know, I drink a lot of coffee, but, you know, if I ever have any trouble with insomnia, I'm going to just read the Democratic memo. It's even lamer than the Republican one.
And longer,
quite a bit longer. And what's funny to me, too, is
it's a nothing triple pounder.
It is. It's a nothing burger and a big one. What's funny to me, too, is that the Democrats today, Monday morning, came out crowing that they had accomplished everything that they had set out to accomplish in this memo, that they provided information that disproved the Republican claims about the Steele dossier, et cetera, et cetera. None of that stuff was true. Jim, what's your view on this?
Well, I agree with Ted. I mean, why do we keep talking about it? This is
this is so boring and silly at this point.
Moscow, it was the Kremlin.
But I mean, it's not in this show. It's the entire media apparatus is filled with this all day, 24 hours. And there's so little to it. First of all, both of these memos, as everybody's saying, you know, was supposed to be a big deal. It was going to destroy the Republic, and nothing particularly
I forgot about
dramatic
that.
In any of them. And each of them is an interpretation of underlying data and underlying documents that we don't have. Even Carter Page said today, we should release all the underlying documents. If you're going to get anywhere, even over this particular issue of how bad the FBI or the investigation was, you've got to see the underlying documents. And that's otherwise you're just listening to the different parties pitching their versions of what happened. So, you know, we have this kind of food fight among Republicans and Democrats. In the meantime, the country's going to hell. The country's going to war. And nobody's paying any attention to the real problems of the United States.
So true.
It's just driving me crazy. Now, there is one document that's interesting or not interesting, because you have to see all the documents, that Bill Binney brought out a few weeks ago, which is a document from the FISA court from October, from April 17, saying that in October 2016, I'll read it, the government apprised the court of significant noncompliance with the NSA's minimization procedures involving queries of data regarding U.S. persons. Full scope of noncompliant querying practices has not been previously disclosed to the court. So something that's not really about any of this.
Help the lay audience understand what that means.
What it is Bill Binney saying the NSA was using criteria to spy on Americans that were too broad. So they were catching up a lot of people in the Trump campaign by using too broad criteria, and they had hidden the problems from the court. And they came back and they acknowledged it. And they did two or three extensions. The court gave them, of course, because the court let them go, two or three extensions to rewrite and redo their thing. So there were some problems that are known. There's a 99-page FISA court document here that says there were some problems, but nobody's even talking about that. This is all, Carter Page met with some Russians, so we had a reason to spy on them, you know? And Papadopoulos met with some Russians sometimes, so we had reasons to think he was a Russian agent.
Yeah, the Democrats' memo actually says, it uses some parse language, but any reader would think, Carter Page is a Russian spy.
Right.
Right? I mean, that's...
Exactly. It's exactly their point. And the basis of that is he met with someone who... have something to do with Russian intelligence. I mean, anybody who met John Brennan or George H.W. Bush met an American spy. So therefore, are they an American spy? I mean, this is kind of insanity, but everybody's... And I can't believe the level at which the Democrats and the media are pushing this. Anybody who's met any Russians got to be a spy, and are you being paid by Russia? And,
You know, and I am fascinated by these terms connected to... or associated with. What does that mean, that person A is associated with person B? Associated how? They met once at a cocktail party?
Yeah, and Ted Rall, going back to Carter Page, and just for the whole audience who might be hearing our show for the very first time at 105.5 FM, we are not Trump supporters. I'm certainly not. John Kiriakou's not.
Absolutely not.
Nope.
So we don't have any Trump supporters here, but what we're talking about is how the investigation of so-called Russian involvement or meddling in the election and all of this is based on basically steering the population towards conclusions that are not proved. There's no real evidence. If there was evidence, we want to talk about the evidence. But so far, there is no evidence. And Ted Rall, the FISA court itself, Reggie Walton, the judge who was the judge in charge of the FISA court, for a while, said a little while ago in an interview, it's not really a court. If the FBI or other intelligence agencies come before the court, they're facing no adversary who challenges their conclusions, their assertions. And they're basically saying to a judge, give us a warrant because it's national security is at stake. And no FISA judge is actually going to say no. And they hardly ever say no because they don't want to be held responsible should something happen down the road. So it's just really a rubber stamp. It's actually not a court, as we understand the word court. And of course, the Democrats are making the argument now that the Steele dossier, which is opposition research paid for by the Democratic National Committee and Hillary Clinton, which was the basis for some of the allegations to the FBI that the FBI used to then try to get the warrant on Carter Page, that this is what was provided to the FISA court, but the FISA court wasn't told that it actually came from opposition research. But now the Democrats in their memo are actually saying, guess what? They did tell the court it was based on opposition research. So what? Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that this kangaroo court, rubber stamp court, learns or doesn't learn that it's based on opposition research, as long as it's rubber stamping what the FBI wants in terms of a warrant or surveillance spy on people, what difference does it matter? Go ahead, Ted.
Yeah, after the Edward Snowden revelations in 2013, there was a lot of a spotlight on the FISA so-called court, which, as you said, is a misnomer. It literally rules against the government fewer than 5 out of 1,000 requests. And there is, as you pointed out, absolutely no one who is in, there is no opposition. In other words, when the FBI or the NSA says they want a warrant, there's no one else in the room who goes to the, these are federal judges doing this freelance, who says, judge, I'm from the ACLU, I'm from the EFF, I'm advocating on behalf of privacy rights. There's literally no one in that room who's charged with doing that. So it is a kangaroo court. And what we used to call these links between or connections between, we used to call that in the McCarthy era a smear. That's what it is. It's a classic smear. And, you know, for example, I mean, there are ties between Donald Trump and Russia because I've been to Russia and I met Donald Trump when I worked on Wall Street. So therefore, there are ties between Donald Trump and Russia. I mean, that's, of course, completely nonsensical. It is a truth that has no impact. It's saying something that might be technically true, but doesn't mean anything. And we are not, you know, the word evidence is really clear here. There is no evidence, forget about proof or even strong indications. We're just waiting. And if this were any other kind of story, if you didn't have an agenda on the part of corporate media to take down this president by this means, which, by the way, is parenthetically odd because there's so many great grounds for impeachment. Why not use one of those? Temperament was a classic one that the founding fathers anticipated. You know, they worried about another George III. They worried about a nut. They worried about someone who was temperamentally unfit to be president, someone who hit the bottle. And, arguably, we have that kind of thing going on right now. But if this were any other kind of story, we wouldn't be talking about it, and it wouldn't still be alive.
Jim Kavanaugh, one minute left. Federal prosecutors have stated on the record that Carter Page willingly came to the FBI in 2013 when individuals suspected of working for Russian intelligence tried to recruit him at an energy conference. One way or the other, I mean, this discussion has been going on with the FBI and Carter Page. And again, not fans of Carter Page, not fans of Trump.
Nope.
But go ahead. Take us out. We have 40 seconds left.
Well, again, on the big picture, this is a substitution of litigation for politics. What the Democrats are trying to do is to win something that they couldn't win politically through litigation. It's a model that the Republicans invented with Bill Clinton. And it's crazy. And meanwhile, the political life of the country is being paralyzed and ignored, and the real social pathologies and problems of the country are being ignored in the favor of this kind of substitute litigation, which is supposed to do what? I don't know, but which is based on guilt by association.
Yeah, social problems. He's right. Jim is right. Social problems that go unattended, bridges that are falling down.
Mm-hmm.
Congress can't take action on any of that.
No. Now the Democrats have their Benghazi. That's what it's come down to.
The Democrats have a choice. Are they going to run on Medicare for all, no wars, infrastructure, or are they going to run on Donald Trump's a Russian agent?
Yeah, that's it. That's the bottom line.
A losing choice.
Okay, we were joined from New York by Ted Rall. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. And we were also joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
China's Communist Party has cleared the way for President Xi Jinping to remain in power indefinitely by abolishing term limits for the presidency. This is a major break from a decades-old rule meant to prevent the development of what the West calls the Mao-like consolidation of power in the hands of one person or one faction. We're joined from London by Jude Woodward. She was London Mayor Ken Livingstone's advisor on culture and creative industries and is the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. Welcome back, Jude.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you for joining. It's big news here, at least in the U.S. media, about the proposal to abolish the two-term limit. Obviously, the Chinese Communist Party has different tendencies, different trends, different factions. That's been true for, you know, as we look back over the decades. Does this signify something internally in terms of the Chinese Communist Party's long-term political orientation or the ascendancy of one grouping over another?
Well, I think that happens in the ebb and flow of the situation. Extending the number of terms doesn't change the fact that has to be agreed by the Chinese Communist Party. And so if Xi Jinping didn't command support, then his term wouldn't be extended. So in a certain sense, it's not as big a change as I think in America, people get much more excited about this because you have a two-term limit for your president. But we don't have this in Europe. There's virtually no countries in Europe that has a term limit for the number of times that you can stand. And so we're not quite so surprised by this.
That said, I hear you on that. It is of significance, though. Otherwise, they would not be doing it. So what do you think the significance is?
Oh, of course, I think it's of significance. I wasn't meaning to imply otherwise. I think what it means is that you've had a series of quite strong leaders. And that has happened to since Mao died. Deng, who was never formally the leader, but following that, you had a series of strong leaders, and it happened to fall into the two-term limit, and there was an obvious successor. The problem with Xi Jinping, I think, at the moment is there's not an obvious successor, and it doesn't fall so simply into a two-year or a 10-year period that the course that he wants to pursue can be best plotted out. And you have Donald Trump in the US presidency. That's new. We don't know what the consequences of that are going to be. So I think it's, in the circumstances, not surprising that the Chinese leadership wants to have the option of not having a possibly unsettling change as a given by their constitution. But obviously it also does mean the consolidation of the group, you know, the grouping around Xi Jinping. But on the other hand, they have been consolidating for some period of time. It means it won't be changed by the imposition of a rule that he can't stand again, though one could see a difficult situation arising out of that, which is he doesn't have to stand down as general secretary of the party, wouldn't have to stand down as head of the armed forces. So you could have a weak presidency where Xi Jinping remained in those positions. So you can see why this would happen and why it would happen in these circumstances. But I agree. I think it is a consolidation of a particular position in the leadership of the Communist Party.
Jude, what practical effect will this have on the Chinese economy? Xi has overseen an economy that's grown steadily. The growth has been robust over the period of his tenure. And he's not been afraid to intervene when there's been volatility, for example, in the Shanghai stock market. What do you think an unlimited term will do to continued economic growth in China?
Well, it depends entirely what policy is pursued. And I think what is the best policy is a matter of debate. And secondly, I don't think it's entirely clear exactly what Xi Jinping's economic policies are, in the sense that certainly in the West, there has been a big push that China should shift from an investment-led and export-led economy to an economy based on domestic consumption, is the terminology used. On the other hand, there are important economists in China and elsewhere, but particularly in China, who don't agree with that. And so the West has looked for signs that this is the direction Xi Jinping is going towards boosting domestic consumption. And there's no doubt domestic consumption has been boosted in China. But whether how far that is pursued and to what degree that is a fundamental reorganization of the Chinese economy, or whether the investment-led growth will continue if directed towards higher tech and more consumer products.
Jude Woodward is our guest. She's talking to us from London. We're talking about the announcement that the Chinese Communist Party may amend its rules so that Xi Jinping would be able to serve beyond the two terms in the party and in the armed forces. Jude, let's talk about the, if you can help us characterize the Xi Jinping grouping that appears to be consolidating its authority on a longer term basis and in a stabilizing way, what the politics of that is. You have had, and we have all witnessed, right-left struggles within the Chinese Communist Party, most notably during the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution. Mao and the Mao grouping at that time, including Lin Piao, launched the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution against what they called capitalist roaders. Later, after Mao's death, the Mao grouping was basically liquidated, not necessarily physically, but they lost their positions of authority and their top leadership were imprisoned. There was the ideological and political struggle that resulted in the Tiananmen Square events in May and June 1989, which ended with the suppression of that movement and the reconsolidation of authority. There's been these kind of bitter, protracted struggles. The people who I'm talking to say, well, American soft power has grown greatly in the last 25 years through think tanks and other exercises of what how soft power is exercised within China, that the American government through NGOs and through these think tanks is recruiting or influencing a new generation, and that perhaps Xi Jinping is countering that tendency by, one, the anti-corruption campaign and also the renewed efforts on the issue of Marxism and ideology. Is there a right-left issue here?
Well, yes, I think there is fundamentally, but I don't think it is the Mao versus capitalist road left-right. I think if it's a sort of left-dengist position, if you like, which is, I think what you've just outlined is very accurate, that there's been a big growth in over the last 25 years in American think tanks, etc. And that's been explicit by Xi Jinping and the current Politburo, to alongside the anti-corruption drive, to try to stress socialism with Chinese characteristics and set up think tanks to develop thought and thinking about the economy, politics, socialism, philosophy, etc., which is not in hock to the West. And that's been aided by the success of the Chinese economy, because more and more experts, homegrown experts in China, instead of looking at furthering their careers by leaving the country, see the best way of furthering their careers to stay in the country. So this is all gelling into a big redevelopment of Marxist and socialist thought, but within a Chinese framework. And I think that is a leftist development, but is not a return to the Cultural Revolution or that kind of left.
Yeah, no, I wasn't suggesting that. I was just using it as a historical marker or a reference point. But again, it seems to me, Jude, we only have 2 minutes left, that the reason this is getting negative coverage in the West, which of course will always make the argument, it seems undemocratic, it seems dictatorial, the consolidation of one-man rule, etc. Of course, Washington doesn't care about that in Saudi Arabia, for instance. The reason that it makes a difference on China is that perhaps people in the Washington political foreign policy establishment were hoping that there was a Boris Yeltsin grouping or a Mikhail Gorbachev Boris Yeltsin grouping, and that Xi Jinping is countering them. 1 minute left. Go ahead.
Well, I think exactly. I mean, if you read the international news media, which I'm sure you do and I have, for the last 25 years. Every 5 years, there is, when there's a change in leadership, it's declared this is going to be the Chinese Gorbachev or the Chinese Yeltsin, and it's not happened. And it's certainly not, and that's what the West wants. So that's what the West hoped for after 1989, hoped would flow from the fall of the Soviet Union in 1992, believed that this is how Jiang Zemin was described, then that's how Hu Jintao was described, and now it's, and they had these hopes of Xi Jinping, and they flounder at each turn because that's not what's happening in China.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from London by Jude Woodward. She was London Mayor Ken Livingston's advisor on culture and creative industries and is the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Momentum is the key word in what could be a true rapprochement between North and South Korea. The possibility of direct talks between the two is a real one. But will U.S. preconditions scuttle any chance of success? We're joined from Washington by Medea Benjamin. She's a prominent peace activist and the co-founder of Code Pink. Welcome back, Medea.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
Medea, you know, we follow the news, and if you compare the situation to what it was, let's say, a month ago or 6 weeks ago with nuclear tests and carrier battle groups heading out to the coast, it's a different world right now, just after 4 or 6 weeks. And there's a real possibility that the two Koreas are going to sit across the table from each other. We saw, you know, these wonderful shows of unity in the Olympics. But then you have Donald Trump. And you have Donald Trump's Defense Department saying not so fast. So what do you think we should expect to see? Is this an opportunity for the Koreas to leave the United States behind and just try to work this thing out between the two of them?
Well, it's a tremendous opportunity. And I think it's fantastic that the two Koreas are talking to each other. But as President Moon of South Korea has said, the U.S. has to be engaged because, because if not, they will be sabotaging this from the sidelines. But basically, that's what he means. So there we go back again to the fact that the U.S. is terrified of peace talks between the North and South. I think it's amazing the beautiful momentum that is built up around the games, just seeing how the North and South women on the team, the hockey team bonded together, seeing how the crowd responded to the North and South, the delegations together. The world is ready for peace to break out, and the problem is the Trump administration. So I think one thing that will really be telling is whether the Trump administration insists on these war exercises going forth in early April, because that is something that could indeed sabotage the peace talks.
Right. If the exercises go forward that simulate the destruction of North Korea and North Korea takes a countermeasure, let's say another missile test, mm-hmm. then we're back to where the Trump administration, I think, wants us to be, which is the seemingly implacable or intractable confrontation, which then gives the U.S. a pretext to ramp things up.
I just wanted to add, Brian, though, it's so interesting because on the one hand, at one point, President Moon had sort of given a stop to Trump by saying that they helped get North Korea to the point of agreeing to peace talks, basically saying that sanctions had worked. And the administration does want to take to be able to say that, look, our sanctions have had such an effect on the North Koreans that now they want to talk. And yet, on the other hand, it is the United States that refuses to talk unless the North Korea gives up its weapons program, which is supposed to be the outcome of the talks, not the precondition for the talks.
And you see that in the conservative media all the time, too, that only Nixon could go to China, only Trump could make peace with North Korea, and that it was this toughness, this public talk of the bloody nose strategy that has now forced the North Koreans to the table.
It's as if the North Koreans' knees are knocking and they're all trembling now.
Exactly.
After having gone through what they've gone through.
And as if North Korea had never been open to peace talks before, that they are suddenly open. And then I heard something fleeting on the radio saying maybe Trump will win a Nobel Peace Prize.
Oh, come on.
Okay. I got to get my ticket.
Yeah, but in a sense, who cares as long as we're not engaged in a nuclear war with North Korea? You know, let them take some credit for it. But right now, the belligerence of the U.S. is still making the whole situation extremely dangerous.
And the other thing that just happened is that Trump, at the end of the Olympics, announced the harshest sanctions ever. And those sanctions are harsh, and they're also unilateral. We've all been talking about, why do Russia and China keep going along with the United States imposing really terrible sanctions on North Korea, sanctions that are designed to create a famine in North Korea?
Right.
And the explanation always is, well, China and Russia are hoping to keep the U.S. inside the UN Security Council process. In other words, a multilateral process that prevents the U.S. from taking unilateral, rash, reckless, war-starting behavior. But here Trump just announced something unilateral, and China has denounced it. This includes sanctioning, I think, 27 shipping companies, which means that the U.S. could interdict North Korean vessels or vessels going to or from North Korea on the high seas. That would be, of course, an act of war, an incident. And yet it seems to me that the Trump administration has set that up also. That stage has been set. So, yes, the talks might go forward under the pretext we're taking credit for it, or it could go in an opposite direction, too, because there are people in the United States that don't want peace to break out. They don't want to, quote, lose South Korea as a puppet or a proxy or at least as an ally. They don't want South Korea to realign, say, with China and North Korea and have peaceful relations. They really are incentivized to keep this conflict going. So it seems, Medea, that there's different factors, different trends, different factions sort of in a race for time with each other because, as John said at the beginning, perhaps momentum is the only thing North and South Korea have going for them. If they can create enough momentum for a diplomatic outcome, it makes it harder for those who seek war to go forward with their plans. Your comments.
One of the things that's really missing from all of this is an invigorated peace movement in the United States that is pushing our government to say, keep this Olympic truce going, go for the talks. We don't want sanctions. Don't start again these military exercises. So I think we really need to build up that voice within the United States, which is a reflection of what the people on the peninsula want, which is a reflection of what the whole global community wants. But we've been way too quiet as a peace movement. And because this momentum is building, I think the time is right to get more of the American voice for peace and pushing our administration than we've had in the past.
And perhaps, well, there are numerous times to do that. But one thing, Medea, and I know you're involved in, those of us who are involved in the Answer Coalition and many other groups are also involved. Here you have Donald Trump wants to have a military parade down the middle of Washington, D.C., tanks rolling, planes overhead, maybe spending $30, $40 million on a military parade, glorifying war, glorifying militarism. And that's going to be Veterans Day weekend, it appears. It seems to me that the anti-war and peace movement forces are going to come out, I think, in the hundreds of thousands of people during that weekend. What do you think?
Well, let's hope for one. Unfortunately, it's also right around the time just after the midterm elections, and so many groups put their hopes into if we only elected more Democrats, things would be better. And certainly for some issues like the gun issue, it would be better. But for a lot of these war issues, it's continuation no matter which party is in power. But we do have to build for that. It is an opportunity. And we also have to connect the issues of the violent shootings that we see, like in the school and in Parkland, with the glorification of the military. The fact that our militaries are in our high schools actually teaching young students how to shoot and a love for weapons and a love for militarism, if we connect those issues with the mobilizations that are happening with the high school students in the next coming months, I think there is a chance of building much more of a movement that is against not only violence at home, but violence abroad.
The historic question here, John, is whether South Korea, which is obviously looking over its shoulder to see whether Washington approves about whether they even talk to other Koreans. I mean, they have limited sovereignty because American troops and the tens of thousands still occupy South Korea. So the question is, will South Korean government, which wants to have normalized relations with the North or a reduction in tensions at least, will they be able to go forward or do they have to get permission from a foreign power? That's a historic question because in the past, no South Korean government has ever made a move without the permission of Washington, which shows the semi-colonial character of the relationship. 1 minute left, Medea. We're going to give you the final word.
Well, I think President Moon in South Korea has been really brilliant in building up the support among South Koreans for these talks, as well as beginning using the Olympics to start the peace talks between the North and South. So I think if there is enough support among the population in South Korea, the U.S. is not going to be able to derail those talks.
I think you're right. We were joined from Washington by Medea Benjamin. She's a prominent peace activist and the co-founder of Code Pink, and she's been very active on North and South Korean peace issues. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Senator Dianne Feinstein, arguably the most important politician in the state of California, was snubbed over the weekend when the Democratic Party declined twice to endorse her for re-election. She faces a stiff challenge from State Senate President Kevin De Leon. We're joined from San Francisco by Natalie Hrizi. She is a teacher librarian and a candidate for California State Insurance Commissioner on the Peace and Freedom Party ticket. And we're joined by Kevin Aiken, the California State Chair of the Peace and Freedom Party and a candidate for State Treasurer of California. Welcome to both of you.
Good to be here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Natalie, let's start with you. Dianne Feinstein is, like I said, arguably the most important politician in the state of California. She's certainly one of the longest lasting politicians in the state of California. This was a very serious snub. What does this mean for her chances of re-election? Do you think that Kevin De Leon can actually beat her?
So I think in terms of her chances of winning the election, this was definitely an obstacle in terms of, you know, support for her from the Democratic Party. I think overall in the state, she still is leading in the polls and she has far more resources, particularly in terms of money, than Kevin De Leon. But I think there's a couple different things going on here. One, politically, it's showing that there is this real frustration with the Democratic establishment, which she represents. She really, as head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, or the highest-ranking Democrat on it, she really represents the establishment. She won't support single-payer health care. She has supported the war over and over again. She's, you know, got a very poor record in terms of supporting surveillance of the general population and the collection of metadata. And all of these things make her really unpopular in many parts of the state, and particularly in the Democratic Party, which is experiencing the rifts. I think another thing that's an element here that really should be discussed is the elections itself in California. So since 2011, we've had a top two primary where the top two vote getters are who goes on to the general election. So while it's quite a long time before the election will be decided, a lot happens now right before the primary, which is really essentially the general election. And I think this was a significant obstacle for Feinstein. And Kevin De Leon, a lot of attention is now being paid to him and will be. And I think he could, you know, garner a lot of support based on this. Although we have to say he didn't get the party endorsement necessarily either, not having reached the 60% threshold he needed to. But I do think, just in terms of the overall Democratic convention and what happened with Feinstein, and not just Feinstein, but you know, the reception of Tom Perez's speech and the other sort of establishment among the Democratic Party, they were really struggling over that weekend in San Diego. And I think this is just another sort of element of that, of the challenge that they're facing in terms of a real sense of anger over refusing to take progressive positions.
Well, let's talk about that. Kevin Aiken, tell us who Kevin DeLeon is. And do you think that Kevin DeLeon approaching this election from the left is actually more appealing to today's California voter than it may have been as recently as 6 years ago?
Okay, there's no doubt that Kevin DeLeon has been taking some progressive positions, and those positions have been resonating with a lot of voters, and particularly a lot of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And there's another factor at play here. He is from Southern California, from the urban centers of Southern California, where most California voters live. He's also from the mainly Mexican-descended Latinos of Southern California, who are a big part of the electorate and a very big part of the Democratic Party electorate. Those folks do not blindly follow whoever has a Spanish name, as witness the complete repudiation by the Democratic Convention of Villaraigosa, the former mayor of L.A., who was actually booed at the convention, especially at a meeting of union Democrats because of his union-busting efforts when he was mayor. But De Leon, who's very progressive on a lot of issues, including particularly immigration, is quite popular among those who've heard of him. Not as many Californians have heard of him as have heard of Feinstein, because Feinstein's been around for a very long time and has been reelected over and over again. But he's going to be pretty well known by the time the November election comes around.
Well, let's talk about November, too, Kevin. Tell us what this unique California-style primary would look like. Let's assume, then, that Feinstein and De Leon are going to be the top two vote-getters. What does November look like? What do the Republicans do?
Well, the Republicans are kind of in a fix. It's one they created themselves. It was Republicans who put top two on the ballot with the assistance of some big-money Democrats. Top two was misrepresented, of course, in all the election propaganda, and it passed narrowly because people were lied to as to what it meant. What it really means is that while everyone gets to vote among all the different candidates in the primary, those votes are essentially meaningless except those for the top two vote getters for each office. And that gives a huge advantage to the big money candidates. And that's why big money was the proposition that established top two.
Yeah, you have a situation, as I understand it, Kevin and Natalie. So in the statewide offices, in this case, running for U.S. Senator, you have, let's say, the top two vote getters are De Leon and Feinstein. But what happens to then the Green Party and the Peace and Freedom Party or the Libertarian Party, the smaller or third parties? None of them get to even be in the general election. I mean, it's quite something that the electoral Democratic choices eventually end. And this was presented as a way to eliminate extremists.
Right.
But what really has happened, Kevin Aiken or Natalie, is it seems to me a very, very narrowing of actually giving voters a Democratic choice, because maybe people aren't paying attention at the primary level. Maybe it's only towards the general election, but essentially Peace and Freedom's gone, probably. I hope not, but probably. Green Party gone. Libertarians gone. Go ahead.
We probably will not be in the November election, although there's a possibility that we might be able to get on in a couple of congressional districts by a maneuver that's too complicated to describe here. But anyway, generally speaking, our candidates and all of the other candidates who are not big money will be eliminated in the June election. And so we'll go on to a November election, which not only will only have two candidates, But for many offices, we'll have two candidates who are from the same party.
That's right.
And in California, this normally means two Democrats, but sometimes it ends up meaning two Republicans. It depends on which party is better able at maintaining discipline. Because if 15 Democrats run and only two Republicans run, even though the Republicans get a small minority of the vote, they may end up both being on the ballot in November, while a very split Democratic Party doesn't get on at all. That's actually happened a number of times in several of our districts where the majority party doesn't even get on the November ballot. It's just an astonishing denial of democracy entirely. So even the majority party can be shut out.
Go ahead, Natalie.
I think that the other thing that's happened is that this has narrowed the political debate for California elections statewide so incredibly. I mean, the general election is generally what people are paying attention to. It's what they prepare for in many ways. It's what the media pays attention to. So there was, you know, before 2011, it was a possibility, and I ran for Congress before then, it was a possibility for a third-party candidate to be on a televised debate, to be part of a statewide discussion or a statewide media. You know, we were on like NBC and other things that were showing all across the state. We were invited to different campuses to be on the state. But because of sort of making the primary election the general election, third-party candidates are not getting a hearing at all, which is the opposite of democracy. It means that the political debates, the political discussions are so limited when we as third-party candidates bring real politics and represent the needs of real people, we're just not even being heard and we're having to really struggle for that. And we're doing it, but it is limiting our opportunities pretty incredibly. And I think the fact that Proposition 14 was sold as sort of, oh, you'll have more choices, you won't be limited to, you know, your own party. It was, you know, a lot of that like rhetoric was supporting more democracy, and really what it did and what we knew it would do was to limit the availability of the opportunity for people in California to have a real political debate and really talk about the issue.
It takes choices away from the voters. We're going to have to leave it right there. We were joined from San Francisco by Natalie Rizzi. She is a teacher, librarian, and a candidate for California State Insurance Commissioner on the Peace and Freedom Party ticket. We were joined by Kevin Aiken, the California State Chair of the Peace and Freedom Party and a candidate for State Treasurer. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important. But to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.